All right. This is the Happy House Hunters. And we go through the six F's of real estate twice a year. We start in January with how to find it, and then how to fund it, how to fix it, how to flip it, how to fill it, and then finally, what is your freedom number? So those are the six F's of real estate. So it's finding, funding, fixing, flipping, filling, and finally, what is your freedom number? And that takes us through June. So in July, we start over. And so in July, we started with Kyle, and Kyle is my co-mod for the Happy House Hunters Mastermind Group. And he actually did our entire episode on how to find that deal. And so tonight we have Adam Messmer, and he's going to talk to us about how to fund that deal. So we're just, you know, two F's into the six F's of real estate for the second half of the year. So we'll continue on, and next month we're going to talk about how to fix it. And of course, everyone, we had a huge conversation last night at our mastermind meetup, where we do actual boots on the ground and we tour actual properties, and Kyle helps us with that. And we had a huge conversation last night that contractors are hard to find these days, and getting projects fixed. And so next month is going to be a great topic on fixing these deals. And then from there, you know, the month after that, we're going to talk about flipping. That's, you know, you just want to buy one, fix it up, resell it, you know, and what those numbers have to look like. And then finally, we're going to talk about buying and holding. And we call that how to fill that real estate. And then finally, what is your freedom number? How many units do you have? Now, the formula that I like, and I don't know, maybe Kyle has a different opinion, we'll ask. But my formula that I like is to flip two and buy one. Flip two and buy one. Because if you can flip a couple and get some cash in your pocket, now you're ready to do a buy and hold, and you can bring cash to the table. So oftentimes that's an easy way to build your portfolio. But that's just one formula of many. And we're going to, you know, that's just one of the ways that you can fund some of those buy and holds, is by flipping a couple first. And then you have the funds that you can actually buy and hold one. But we're going to talk to Adam tonight, and we're going to find out all the other ways that you can fund all of this real estate. And so, Adam, I'm going to turn it over to you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you even got into funding. How did you get into the mortgage business?
Sure. Yeah. No, thanks for that, Kathy. So I started in banking and finance in 2008. Because my timing is amazing.
For those of you that don't remember, everything crashed around 2008 through 2010.
Yeah. The dark days and the long, long ago and the before time. Back then, it was wild. So I got into banking in a banking call center back in 2008, smiling and dialing, and just, I was customer service for online banking for a big bank, which, that's the seventh circle of hell. That's also, that's like the salt mines of banking. But so I did that, and did that for a few years. And eventually they came to me and they said, hey, do you want to be in branch banking? And I said, and wear a suit? And they said, yeah. And I'm like, I don't know about that. And they're like, come on, you'd be good. And I said, okay. So I did that. And then eventually worked my way into wealth management, and being a debt advisor for wealth management for big banks. So I did that for about 6 years, off and on. And, that was continuously for 6 years, now that I think about it, from 2014 through 2020. And, as a part of that, you'd help organize debt for wealthy customers of the bank in such a way that was advantageous, usually to their retirement.
So what does it mean when you organize? What does that mean? What did that mean to you when you say you organize their debt?
Sure. Making sure that all the debt makes sense. So okay. Like, for instance, let's say you had somebody that bought something back in like 1996 or something, and they've never refinanced. It's rare, but it happens. And especially like if it's like grandma or grandpa, they bought something, they just set it and forget it, and they never questioned, they never changed anything, they never did anything. And now you're helping grandma sort through everything. It's like, wait a minute, there's this 12% interest rate on this mortgage. What are we doing? You would
when
help
interest is that. At 3%. Yeah.
When interest is at 3%. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or even 6%, you know, whatever. You would work hand in hand with, I would work hand in hand with a financial planner from the bank, financial advisor, financial planner, that would help on the asset management side. And something that I found to be a common thread among everybody there was they had real estate as a component of their portfolio. So that was one side of it. So that was the professional side of it. And then eventually after a long stint of that, I became a mortgage banker and then a mortgage broker because I realized it's way better.
Okay.
Yeah. So, on the personal side, I grew up in real estate. And, Saturday morning it was 8 a.m. and, you had to get out of bed and go, you know, mow grass or paint because there's a new tenant coming in. And, so I was always around it and my wife was always around it. And so we eventually ended up buying a double and have house hacked for like a decade, which gets old, but, everybody's cool. We love everybody. All our neighbors are awesome.
Christine wants to know,
we use that equity to buy an Airbnb and that's how we met, was through networking, and we have that podcast.
Right. Well, Christine wants to know, what's the difference between a banker and a broker?
That's a great question. So you have lenders and you have brokers. I'm a broker. Lenders are the source of the money. So they are the ones that are actually doing the loan. The broker is the one that connects the borrower with the money. Right. And people are like, well, why don't I just go straight to the banker? And that's a great question. I don't know. You can Google them. But one of the things that a broker offers is we know all these banks. We know all these banks. We know all these lenders. We know all the different institutions. We know all the capital sources. And you go to a broker, you usually go to a broker when it's hard to find something. Because it's like, okay, do you need a Fannie or Freddie loan? Actually, go to a broker because chances are their pricing is a lot better because they can get access to wholesale pricing. Whereas when you go to a bank, if you go direct to your bank,
they're selling their own products, right?
Yeah. They're selling the same thing that the broker's selling, but you have to pay for the chase to put the guy in, right? With me, I'm just a guy. So overhead for brokers typically is a lot less. They get access to similar wholesale pricing. So they can often be very competitive, even in conventional type of lending. But what I specialize in is investment real estate, commercial real estate, weirder stuff, not the weirdest stuff. I mean, I can get money for pretty weird stuff, but I was looking at an airport like a month ago and that was kind of interesting. But it was like owned by some crazy old person that didn't have any records. And so that was not going to happen, but yeah. So
somebody wanted to buy an airport and you were trying to find funding for them for the airport, but there was no records to show that this airport even had any cash flow.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, really what I ended up advising, because there's value there, because obviously there's commerce that's happening. Right. So, and to kind of frame it up, because like, what do you mean you buy an airport? Who buys an airport? So this is what it was. It was a small privately owned airport that was connected to a housing development, and the housing development, each house as part of their HOA paid a slip fee, meaning you could park your plane there. Mm-hmm. So it had this wild thing. You had like this built-in community of like aviation enthusiasts who owned houses at the airport. So they're paying like rent to keep it going. And then in addition to that, there's tons of like hangars that they converted to self-storage facilities. Right. So it's like, and they were charging like next to nothing for this space. And they had a laundry list of people, like a 1-year waiting list to even get in there to rent a part of a hangar in an airport. It's crazy. So there was definitely money that was being exchanged, but the guy didn't keep any records. So the solution to that is start keeping records and call me in a year or two. you know, until we can prove to a lender that you've got something, you know.
Yeah, Mark always has dreams. My Mark is a pilot, of course, and his dream is to own one of those properties.
Yeah.
On a runway. Yeah. I get it. Yeah, I got
There's
it.
One in Illinois if you're looking.
Yeah. Kyle says Mark's ears are tingling. I bet they are. Yeah. I get it. Yeah.
But yeah, so that's the big difference between a banker and a broker. Brokers have more fun, I would say. Yeah. For sure.
So run us through some of the products that you have, because again, this is the Happy House Hunters. And because we talk about the six F's of real estate, how to find and fund and fix and all those things, a lot of the folks that are tapping in this evening in our audience or are going to be listening to this later want to be investors they are investors, or they're at some place in that investing world. And, you know, sometimes you, like me, I started off saying, okay, well, I'm going to use the equity in another property to launch my first commercial purchase. And mm-hmm. so I did that. And then once I had equity in that building, I could use that equity and help, you know, launch my second purchase. Well, at some point you run out of equity. Mm-hmm. Or a great deal comes along and you're like, oh my gosh, I would love to have that property, but I haven't, you know, my equity hasn't grown to the point where I can draw it back out again in a line of credit or however I want to do that. And then of course, there's the whole thought of, you know, why use my money? Why can't I use somebody else's money? Especially if I'm going to do a flip mm-hmm. where I know I'm going to have this nice windfall once I get it fixed up and put it back on the market with what the market's doing these days. And so describe to us some options that folks can get into, because that's the big question, is what kind of funds can we get and what do we have to bring to the table as an investor?
Sure. Yeah. So there's a variety of different ways that you can get access to money. Like one of the easiest ways to get into it, to get into real estate and to real estate investing is to house hack, is to do what I did. Just buy something, a duplex or a triplex or a fourplex, and live in it. And for at least a little bit, you end up saving a ton of money. And, you know, that's a great thing to do. If you're going to use a conventional loan for that, 99 times out of 100, a conventional or an FHA loan. So that's like traditional financing that's government subsidized. That's the cheapest money that's out there. There is not cheaper money than the money that is subsidized by the government. Get that, you know. Eventually you outgrow that. You can outgrow that in a couple of different ways. One, you get 10 of them. If you have 10, then you're done. Then you can't get any more. Now you can get 10 and your spouse can get 10 and your kid can get 10. And so there's ways around it. But then you've got just like a smorgasbord of loans that are filling out. And I'll get to how to deal with that in a little bit, but conventional financing is determined primarily, by the property, by credit, and by the debt to income ratio. So how much do you get paid versus what your outgoing expenses are? What I would say stage would be if you've outgrown your DTI or your DTI is problematic, you can do what's called low documentation or asset-based or DSCR-based lending. So that's all three words all mean basically the same thing. And that is you're using the income and the expenses of the property to qualify for the loan rather than your personal income. So in that scenario, a lender's going to look at your gross rents from the property. And in its most basic sense, they will look at that compared to the PITIA of the mortgage payment. That's the principal, interest, taxes, insurance, and association fees, if applicable. Association fees are HOA fees, condo fees, anything that would have that would be like you would be required to pay in order to live in the place or own the place. The ratio that they're looking for is 120% of the PITIA, right?
Okay.
So that means whatever your mortgage payment is, you should be making at least 20% more and in order to do that deal. So if your mortgage payment is $1,000, that rent should be $1,200.
And if you can verify that, if you can prove that, because again, that's they want to see proof of that.
They kind of, well, yeah, yes, they do. But how you think about it, it's like, okay, so what are they going to take? Are they going to take a lease? Well, yeah, they'll take a lease. But really what they're going to take, to be very precise, is they're going to take the lesser of the market rent or the lease that you have in hand. And that's to prevent, like, hey, buddy, why don't you just sign this lease for $2,000 for, you know, a one bedroom in Marietta, Ohio? And like, no, that so they're hip to that. And that's why they take the lesser of the two. So as part of the appraisal, what happens is something called a 1007 or a market, a schedule of market rent. And that is where the appraiser says, okay, this place is this, you know, these other comps are renting for such and such. Let's figure out what the average is. And that's what your market rent is.
Okay. So now they're just going to look at the numbers then. They're just going to see, do you have enough cash flow coming in to support the deal?
Minimum credit score on that's going to be a 660.
Which is not bad.
That's easy. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, rates are more expensive, usually a point or two, and beyond, for this kind of lending, because it's technically a riskier loan to the lender because they're not verifying every little detail of everything that is going on. Plus, it's private money. This isn't government subsidized money. The reason why Fannie and Freddie loans are so inexpensive is because they're government subsidized. So it's cheap
and
money.
And government guaranteed.
Government and government guaranteed. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I get that. So this money comes from like hedge funds. You know, DSCR money comes from hedge funds and large capital groups that are, you know, trying to make a buck, which is cool. So that's one way. And then of course, I mean, with renovations, if you're looking for renovations, if you're looking for something and you don't have a great background in rehabbing, like you're new to it, you don't have a lot of experience, there's hard money. So hard money is true bad asset-based lending, where they literally just look at the price of the house, what the rehab budget is, and what the ARV is. And then based on those three numbers, they'll lend money. And your credit score, you got to have like a 600 typically for hard money. That's significantly more expensive than conventional. And it's a little bit more expensive than DSCR money. But like I saw one today that was in the eights for DSCR and 12 for hard money for as far as rate goes. You know, so, but anyways, so then once you get beyond DSCR and hard money, cause that is good money. Like what DSCR is like handy for is, 1 to 4 family properties where it's, especially if you're making a bunch of money on it, like as far as the monthly cash flow goes. If you've got high cash flow, low cost, so like an $80,000 house that kicks off like $1,000 a month, like those exist. And, you know, a DSCR loan is great for that because you don't want to have to supply everything under the sun in order to do it. The other thing that's nice about DSCR lending and hard money is they typically don't report to credit, although some DSCR lenders do. So you want to get clarification from your broker on that because different lenders have different programs. But as long as you close in an LLC, it doesn't report to personal credit, which is awesome. What was the other thing I wanted to tell you? So I forget where I was going with the DSCR thing, but beyond DSCR and hard money, then you get into commercial financing. And commercial financing is otherwise like, so it's typically involves full underwriting. So what full underwriting means is 3 years of tax returns, both personal and business, a year-to-date P&L or profit and loss statement for whatever your business is, any businesses that you own. If you own more than 25% of a business, be prepared to supply 3 years of tax returns and a year-to-date profit and loss statement, right? And then beyond that, an REO schedule. So REO schedule, that's a real estate owned schedule. So any real estate that you own would need to be on that schedule. And a schedule is going to be anything that is pertinent and broken out about the property. So is there a loan amount? Who is the bank? What is the mortgage payment? What is the monthly tax payment? What is the monthly insurance payment? Mm-hmm. Are those escrowed into the mortgage? All those things are like wildly important. So it's funny because every once in a while I get schedules from people and it's like their own like calculation. It's like, okay, this is the entire mortgage payment and all the gas and all the electric. And then like, this is like dog money. I'm like, what was dog money? I don't even know what that is. Still to this day, I saw that get on schedule. And then like all these different things. And then if I hit this number, then I make like 45%. It's like these crazy wily, like, spreadsheets that are, don't mean anything. So just break out those expenses, and it will do your broker and banker a huge favor.
I keep an actual, spreadsheet, a running spreadsheet current all the time, because you never know when that deal's going to come along. And that way, you know, even if you have to tweak a couple of numbers, like you've paid a mortgage down and you're like, okay, my payoff is now less than what my last schedule said. You can update that, but I can update mine rather quickly and just print it out. I just keep it handy all the time. Joe wants to know, how do we get a line of credit on investment property? And that's how is you've got to have your records and put your numbers together. And then there are lenders out there that will give you a line of credit on the investment property itself.
That's true.
That's what I did with my salons. I bought my first salon, and once I had enough equity in that one, the lender that I was using allowed me to portfolio it together with my second salon. And they actually, you know, used the equity out of the first one to fund the entire deal. And I ended up having two salons. And they use both properties as collateral. But again, they wanted to see my numbers. They wanted to see what was the income coming in off of that first salon building.
So let's say you did a commercial deal, and that's full underwriting, and you've got all your stuff together, and your package is beautiful, and you hand it off. What do you get for it? Well, typically what you're looking at with full underwriting on the commercial side are terms in the 20 to 25 year range. Terms 10 to 25 years for term. 25 is really long. 20 is kind of the top end. Yeah. 10 to 20, I'll call it 10 to 20 years. And then your rate would be fixed for chunks of time. Typically what a lot of commercial lenders are doing now are called resets. So it's kind of like an ARM. So with an ARM, it's fixed for five, like a 5-1 ARM, you're fixed for 5 years, and then it resets every year after that. The rate does, based on an index and a margin. The index is usually like something like, you know, the 5-year T-note or the 10-year T-note or something along those lines. And then a margin, which is just extra money that's put on top of that so that the lender makes money. That's how they make money. So with a reset, you've got a similar concept where it's fixed for 5 years, but then it resets one time and then it's fixed for another 5 years. And if it's a 10-year term, then at the end of the 10 years, then you would either have an underwriting event to possibly renew, or you would just refinance out. So you have shorter periods of time. You're not going to get a 30-year fixed typically in the commercial lending space. So you're going to have some kind of reset. But what I have seen in the rate environment in that space, though, is when you compare a 20-year note at whatever the going rate is, it typically works out to be very similar in payment to the 30-year note if you were to have a 30-year DSCR loan for a similar property. So, because you can use commercial financing to buy 1-4 family houses. A lot of people don't know that. Now, typically they might have minimums, so you can't go real low on them. But, you know, if you've got like a $150,000 loan, a lot of commercial banks, well, no, I don't want to say a lot of commercial banks will entertain that. Every commercial bank is like wildly different in what their appetite is. So that's the other thing of why to use a broker is it's like, do you really want to call all these banks? And then who are you going to call? You're going to call like the bank and then get some teller that like doesn't know what you're talking about. And then they send you their manager and then you wait for the manager to call you back. And then you got to call, oh, who do you got to talk? You got to talk to Rob. Well, Rob's on vacation, but his assistant's in and he can help you. Whatever. And it's like, that's a pain. Mm-hmm. Call a broker. It's like, hey, I got like 5 things ready to go. What do you want to do? And I can come up with the requirements pretty quickly. But anyways, I digress. Where were we going? We were talking different types of financing. We were building up. So we started with conventional. We went hard money. We went DSCR. We went into full underwriting for commercial. So what's next? Ooh. Oh,
quick question before you go into what's next. Joe wants to know, is on commercial lending, do they need to be the first lien holder? And I'm going to say they do if they're funding the property. However, if you already have the property funded and you just want to pull the equity out in a commercial line of credit, then that commercial line of credit would be a second lien holder if you still had a first. Am I correct, Adam?
If you can find somebody to take second position. I mean, seconds are hard right now. Nobody... Yeah. So that's something that's happening right now is credit is becoming a little bit harder to get because nobody knows what's going to happen with the credit markets and where the interest rates are going. And so nobody really wants to commit to too much. And lines of credit can be a challenge to get. I mean, they exist for investment real estate, but they're not, most banks don't offer them, I would say. Most lenders don't offer commercial lines of credit. For investment property specifically. And when they do, if they're going to take second position, they also want to be in first position. That's typically going to be your best bet to get a line of credit in that scenario.
Now, I do have Canal Banking in Canal Winchester. They are a small kind of a hometown bank. It's actually a division of Vinton County Bank.
Yeah.
And they have their own board that, you know, reviews all of their loans and that sort of thing. And they do commercial lending. And if, like you said, if they have the first mortgage on a commercial property,
yeah,
and now you've paid that down and you have some equity and now you want to pull some money out, but you really don't want to refinance because maybe you got a great rate and yeah, you really don't want to refinance that, they will take a second and give you a line of credit, but they're already the first, see. So mm-hmm, they're already on the property. So, and they have done that for me a time or two.
Yeah. So, So if you have an existing relationship with the lender, then check there first, because that's going to be your best bet. If you don't, then call a broker, because we can usually find something. But first lien positions are definitely wildly more popular than second lien positions.
Yes.
So we've touched on kind of the different types of lending. There's a couple other things that are beyond this that are somewhat interesting. And I won't spend a ton of time on them because it's like, you need like $3 million to do a couple of them. But like, before I get into that, I would say that a major component of this, of funding something, is also it centers around the kind of one of the primary principles of this business of the business of investment real estate. And that is networking. Because if you can get a rich buddy to sign some loan docs, then you can have a deal for sure. Like, it doesn't take a lot. So, for instance, if you're seeking $1 million, and you have somebody that already has $1 million and they're like, hey, I'll be a guarantor for $1 million. That's a good deal. Now, there's got to be a lot of other things that work out. The numbers have to work. It has to make money. You got to hit. You still have to hit a DSCR, even though we're doing all this extra underwriting. That's a debt service coverage ratio again. But you know, a rich friend is helpful, and by rich friend I mean business partner.
We were just chatting before I started recording. We just did our boots on the ground this week. As a matter of fact, last night we just did our boots on the ground. Which is our little mastermind for the Happy House Hunters. And Kyle is on with us. So say hello, Kyle. Kyle is incognito today with his camera, but he's with us.
Hey, everybody.
Kyle is a realtor, and he gets us in a lot of these properties that we tour. But we had the opportunity to meet up with Josh Hively last night, and Josh has just, he and his partners have just purchased an office building because the tenant, the master tenant in there, had the first right of refusal when it went on the market, and they decided to let their first right of refusal expire. They weren't interested in purchasing it. And since Josh was a tenant as well, he and his one partner actually rented office space there, they decided to pursue it when it came their turn to take a look at the deal. And they didn't use any of their own money. They're using all, rich partners, if you will. They have these other folks through networking that they have met, and these other folks agreed to invest in this office building again because the numbers work. And so they didn't use any of their own money in this deal. And so now they're putting together their rehab plan, and it's going to be all cosmetic from what we can see. And so now they're getting ready to do all the cosmetic updates and get the thing rented again and have it start, bringing in cash flow.
And I think it really illustrates the point that there is way more money than there is real estate. There is way more money that is out there. It's the deals that are hard to get. So if you don't have money and you're trying to put something together, the value that you can bring to somebody that already has the money is the deal. Is mm-hmm. Can you structure the deal? Can you manage the deal? Can I hand you a check or sign some loan documents and not have to do anything or not have to do much? I mean, if you can do that, finding somebody that will do that is not challenging. That is not, if you network, is not challenging. It's finding the deals that make sense. Then do your numbers. And don't get emotionally attached to it and all that, stuff.
Yeah, all the stuff that we hear all the time.
Yeah.
We have some folks in the Happy House Hunters that not only are finding great deals, and Kyle is very instrumental in helping us find our great deals. We now have some Happy House Hunter members that are also doing private lending. So they are part of that investing group that's willing to invest in someone else that finds the deal.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and it's like, well, why do, well, you know, what if it's just a bunch of newbies that go to the networking things? No, all the rich guys go to the networking things too, because they're looking for you. They're looking for people that can help with deals because they're busy doing rich guy stuff.
Yep. I get it. I get it.
Yeah. But how are we doing on time? Okay. Yeah, we're good on time.
We're good.
So we were talking about like escalating and like other investment, or not investment, but lending, financing options that are kind of interesting. Okay. So check this out. Hey, Kathy, conventional lending, Freddie Mac, right? How many units can you buy with on a property with a Freddie Mac loan or a conventional loan? It's a trick question.
But I'm going to say four.
Four. That's the maximum, yeah. Right? 1 to 4. So Freddie Mac has a really cool program called the Small Balance Program, Small Balance Loan Program, BSBL program. And it is for commercial multifamily. So anything more than 5 units, but I mean, can go to hundreds of units, right? You can buy apartment complexes with it. I mean, if it fits within these certain guidelines. And those guidelines are for loan amount, 1 million to 7.5 million. So
which starting at 1 million is it, that's not hard to do when you're doing 5 or more units.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And so, so you've got like a 20 unit that's going for like $1 million or whatever, you know, well, it'd have to go for more than $1 million because they're not going to finance 100% of it, but they'll do like 70 to 75%, you know. I haven't looked at the guidelines in a little while, but they'll fix a rate for, you know, 5 to 7 years. And then they'll, if you want, which let me get back to the rate thing in a second, but they'll amortize that thing for 25 to 30 years, which is pretty cool. Because like I said, you know, you're usually only seeing 20-year amortizations, maybe 25-year amortizations, but 30-year, you often don't see that in the commercial space. But again, because it's a government special entity, a GSE, it's they're able to do that. So rate, something that's interesting about rate in commercial real estate, and I kind of alluded to it when we were talking about the full underwriting option, is it's fixed rates aren't necessarily what you even want, because to fix a rate is a risk to the lender that rates will go up, right? Because it's an asset to you, because you reap the benefit of the fixed rate, because you know exactly what it's going to be. But it's a, you know, it's a challenge for the lender. It's something that they have to overcome. So you can get cheaper rates potentially by having variability to your rate in what's called a rate float. So where the rate could change weekly, I mean, monthly. And if you're willing to accept that kind of variability in the rate, you can oftentimes get a rate that's substantially less than the fixed rate option. So when you get into this space of commercial that's beyond $1 million and is with something like the Freddie Mac small balance program, SBL program, small balance loan program. You're given like a menu, a grid of rate options that include whether or not you have a prepayment penalty. And the options are kind of myriad different things that you've got there. But one of the other things that's pretty interesting about rates is something called a credit swap. So the credit swap, you know, traditionally you pay off a loan early, you pay a prepayment penalty. But the credit swap, whether you pay a prepayment penalty is determined by whether or not the rate has gone up or down. The market rate has gone up or down for that loan since you took it out, right? So in other words, if I took a loan out at 5%, in let's say November, and then paid it off in 2 years later, and the rate was at 9%. Assuming that it was paid ahead of schedule, the lender in a credit swap scenario may pay you to pay off the loan. How crazy is that? So, which it makes sense. It makes in like.
Because they want to get rid of that low rate.
It's intuitive. Yeah, because they want to get rid of the low rate. So like I had a colleague that told me about a loan that was paid off recently for, I don't know, like $3 or $4 million. And they got a check for like $280,000 because they fixed it back in like October when rates were significantly lower. And they've escalated significantly since then. We've had the largest rate increase in the last 6 months that we've had in the last 20 years. And so this dude got like 280 grand for paying off his loan because he had to sell the property or something because there was a better deal that came along or whatever the reason was. I don't forget exactly what it was, but like, what a perk, you know? Now the opposite's true with a swap. So if the rate decreases, then that's going to increase your prepayment penalty significantly. So, proportionally.
Yeah, I get it. But you have to look at all those numbers when you're doing mm-hmm. these deals. And so it mm-hmm. makes a difference. And this is again, what we teach in the Happy House Hunters. It makes a difference if you're looking to flip a property versus to buy and hold it. It makes a difference on the front end. And always know that you're going to make your money on the front end of the deal. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to know what you're purchasing it for. Now, again, I get it. I have a couple of times when I'm purchasing and maybe I want to buy and hold, and I'm not sure exactly how I'm going to use the property as a buy and hold, but I already know that I'm going into it with a buy and hold. I know that mm-hmm. I'm going to buy it long-term and I'm going to hold it, mm-hmm. but it might make a difference. I might try to do a short-term rental, but I always have an out. If for some reason I can't continue the short-term rental there, let's say the city I'm in, you know, at the stroke of an ink pen decide that they want to outlaw short-term rentals. Mm-hmm. So for any reason, I always have to have a plan B that, okay, then maybe I could use it as a midterm rental. And if I can't use it as a midterm rental, I can use it as a long-term rental.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I go into the deal at the beginning knowing that it's going to be a buy and hold. I'm going to hold that one. I'm not going to flip it in 6 months, 12 months, 24 months. I know that I'm going to hold that one long-term. So I'll look at my numbers and I'll maybe eliminate some of those financial funding options because they're not going to be good for long-term. But if you're flipping something, then the interest rate is not as important if you're going to flip it as soon as you're done fixing it.
Yep.
And put it back on the market. Then oftentimes there, you don't have to be too concerned about what those interest rates are. You're mm-hmm. more concerned about funding the deal and grabbing the deal on the front end, knowing what it's going to be worth as soon as you fix it, what the after repair value is going to be.
And did we talk about with commercial, full underwriting, commercial lending, wrapping in renovation costs? Did we talk about that?
No.
Uh-uh. Okay. So that's huge. So that's another, I can't believe that escaped my mind. So check this out. So if you're in a situation where if you've got like a good W-2 job and you've got some like nice income and your DTI is really low, your debt to income ratio is really low, and you want to buy something and you're not under a time crunch because you're buying from a wholesaler and they need to close in like 36 hours or something crazy. If you've got a little time and you can close in 45 to 60 days, then you can do renovation deals through commercial lending. So like right now I'm looking at a deal in a vacation area for it's a cabin that has been a little run down and needs a little TLC. And so they're buying for 150-ish, 160-ish. They're putting like 100 into it. And I think it's going to ARV for like 400-ish.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, so like pretty decent, but they're going to keep it as a short-term rental. Mm-hmm. And when they do, we should have them on the podcast. But
absolutely.
So, I mean, if the numbers work, potentially you could be at 80% loan to value for the purchase and then 100% of rehab, so long as you're less than 80% of ARV after everything's said and done. So
in this deal, if they buy it for 150, they're putting 100,000 in it. So they're going to have 250 in it, but the mm-hmm. ARV is going to be maybe 400, even 350 yeah. or 400 at the other sure. end. They're way under their 80%.
Way under. Yeah.
yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So they could virtually borrow the amount to buy the property and to fix it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, they would need 20% of the purchase price. Mm-hmm. They would need reserves. So they would want to have some kind of reserves. I mean, it's kind of like vague as to what those guidelines are for some of the commercial lenders. They don't want every single one of your dollars to be in this deal. You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
But if you wanted to do a flip, not a flip, because it really isn't meant for flipping. Like, because you usually have a prepayment penalty. I mean, if you really think you're going to make a ton of money and you don't mind paying a prepayment penalty of like 5% in the first year, then then go do it. But if you don't want to do that, then it's great for a buy and hold scenario where you're fixing, you're buying, you're fixing, and you're renting it out. So like mm-hmm. like a mixed use building, like a lot of hard money people do not want to lend on mixed use. Some do, they're more expensive. The ones that will lend on something outside of the 1-4 family box are generally going to be more expensive than the people that will that only want to stay in that box, you know.
Well, because you have more options, I think.
Yeah.
It's all about risk. It's all about exactly. that risk factor. Exactly. Yes, yeah. absolutely. Absolutely. I want to ask if anybody has any questions. Yeah, please in the chat so that we can ask Adam. So Adam, pick one of your deals, no names though, but pick one of your deals that was a problem, and how did you get through it? Because Ooh. That's one of the things that as investors, you know, we don't know what we don't know until we get there. And then we think, of course, we're the only person that's ever had to face that.
So what I'm looking at, so I'm trying to murder a deal before it even starts. Like I'm looking at a deal like a hawk and trying to find where the cracks are and what the problems are before we ever even get into an application. So a lot of it is like a puzzle where you're looking through, it's like, okay, so what do you have? And what do you have that we can work with in order to make this loan work? And so when you say like, what's a problem deal that you've had? All of them are a problem. They're all deals that need to get done. Now, some of them are a lot easier than others, but every deal has something that you need to keep an eye out for. So like, for instance, if you're doing commercial financing, be prepared for 3 years of tax returns, a personal financial statement, an REO schedule. If you have those three things, and P&L. If you have those four things, you can get answers pretty quickly as to whether or not something's going to work. It's because there's a lot of like theory that goes into lending. And it's like, okay, theoretically, if this is what you're, if this number is this and this number is that, and it all fits in the problem, then yeah, it works. But okay, let's see it. We have to see the numbers. Like, okay, cool. You make 100 grand? Great. Do you really make 100 grand, or do you make 50 grand and your wife or your spouse makes 50 grand and you know, you're going in on this partnership and her money isn't counted or whatever, you know, there's a million different ways to look at something. But as far as best practice would be, have a loan package ready to go. Because if you can, because honestly, the loan officer, the broker, the banker that gets something like handed to them, like, hey, here's all my numbers, and it's in a nice little package ready to go, they're going to be probably more responsive than somebody that has no idea what they're talking about, has no idea what kind of documents that they need, and it takes more time, mm-hmm. you know? So that's like the best thing that you can do is just have that loan package ready to rock.
And the last one that I did, I did it on a condo, and I did a commercial note on this condo because I wasn't going to live in it. I was buying it as an investment. And not only did they want to have my spreadsheet with my numbers on it, on the real estate that I currently own, with, you know, what is the taxes on each one? What's the mortgage on each one? What's the payoff on each one? What's the insurance on each one? They actually wanted to see the declaration pages of each of those insurance policies.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot.
You know what? I added that to my packet. And so now that's part of my packet.
Yeah. And lenders, they vary on that. The whole declarations page thing. Cause I have, I have done some loans where it's like, oh yeah, well I need 30 declaration pages. So there's a tip. It's like, okay, get a good insurance person. Make sure your insurance person is responsive and, you know, is reachable, because as long as I have their email address, I can email them and get all that stuff, you know, as a broker. And if I don't do it, then I can have my processor do it. And it's like pretty easy to get that kind of stuff ready to go, especially if it's all through the same person.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mine's all through the same agent. And actually all of that is online. So I can go in at any time and just forward it right mm-hmm. to the loan.
Yep. Oh yeah. So that works really well. Oh yeah. Yeah. Ready to rock PDFs. None of this paper stuff. No, don't scan it. Like, come on, man. Yeah. Yeah.
No, nobody wants all that paper.
Yeah.
Nope. I get it. I get it. Yeah. So anyway, so pick, what is your biggest problem case recently that you've worked on and how did you overcome it?
Biggest problem.
Besides the airport.
You know, I've had some families buying houses for relatives that are planning on renting, and they are renting. I mean, they're renting, and so they're doing hard money for those types of loans, where they're renting to, you know, an aunt or an uncle or a family member. So you could do hard money. There are some, like, not quite hard money. They're DSCR loans that don't ask a lot of questions. And so those are really useful to get those types of things done.
What kind of a term though on something like that? Because they wouldn't want to have to pay that off if they're going to rent it to a family member.
So typically it's what it is. It's they would otherwise qualify for conventional financing, but they've done stupid things on their taxes or whatever. I mean, they've made some mistakes financially and they need a year to clean them up.
Okay.
Yeah. So, that's like some clutch stuff where it's like, we close in like a week. It's like, oh, they've been going through a traditional conventional lender to buy this thing for their tenant relative. And at the last minute, the whole thing falls apart because they didn't file taxes last year or something stupid. Like,
okay. Now, with that said, that triggers some thoughts for me. And we've got some folks on the call. If you are self-employed, and again, for those of you that know my background, I ran beauty salons for about 25 years. I had 5 salons and all my girls were independent contractors, which meant they were not employees. They just rented a chair, you know, a styling chair or a nail table, whatever that we called it, a booth. They rented a booth space for me and they paid rent. And so they were not employees of mine. And so their customers would pay them directly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a gal would come in, get her hair cut. She would stand up and, you know, put $20 bills on the table, or mm-hmm. she would come in and get her nails done and she would put $20 bills on the table. So the problem with that is a lot of these stylists decided that they didn't have to file 100% of their income because who would know?
Sure.
And I didn't know as a salon owner because, you know, I didn't work in all 5 of those buildings and the customer paid the stylist directly. Mm-hmm. So I would always tell these stylists, you cannot mm-hmm. have it both ways. You can't tell the IRS that you didn't make very much money to keep your taxes low and then try to tell the car dealership that actually you did so that you could qualify to buy that car.
Yeah.
And so you can't have it both ways. So I'll just say this, because again, you have to verify that income. So if you're listening to this later on and you're one of those that are self-employed and some of your income is cash so that you know that you don't have to claim it, just know that you can't have it both ways. You can't say that you don't make very much money on one hand and then try to go qualify for a loan where
you can. There are loans that are no income loans, but they're expensive. So I have a loan that's 65% loan to value for purchase and there's no income qualification and you can live in the house, but it's like 9% and 65% LTV. I mean, it's a bummer of a loan, but
it's there.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and for some people it makes sense. Like I have done those usually for like retirees where like they just retired or they just sold their business and they've got plenty of money. And especially if the house isn't particularly expensive, then it's like, well, whatever, you'll just refinance eventually, you know?
Right.
But the way, so it's like, well, wait a minute. I thought all those loans existed before 2008 and isn't that what crashed the economy? No, because those loans did absolutely no verification of anything. This does a credit check. So there's a minimum credit requirement. There's a minimum down payment. So those loans pre-2008 didn't have you could 100% finance things. So you do have to have some skin in the game. And then the third mitigating factor is reserves. You have to have anywhere from 3 to 18 months of reserves, and 1 month's reserves is equal to 1 month PITIA of the mortgage payment.
Okay. Well, yeah. Good to know. This is all great information. So folks that are listening, we're coming up to the top of the hour. So folks that are listening, please put your comments in the chat if you're on the call, your comments and questions, and we'll get those answered. And in the meantime, I am going to share my screen very quickly here and show you. This is my website, and you see here at the top that is just under kathybenner.com. And if you scroll down the page, you will see all of our free meetups. And so just scroll down to the 6 F's of real estate, the Happy House Hunters free meetup replays. You can click through there to learn more, free button, and it'll take you right over to the replays. And so if you go there, you can find all our replays. We've got a course. We also have a mastermind. So for anybody that wants to join our mastermind, you're welcome to join. If you do the mastermind, you get the course automatically included in with the mastermind. But definitely click through and get all the free replays. Again, we go through the 6 F's of real estate twice a year. We have a different presenter or a different speaker each month. Christine wants to know, dust off your crystal ball, and where are we going with rates, Adam?
My crystal ball's in the shop, Christine. I don't know, man. I saw this coming. I mean, I definitely saw interest rates coming here. There is some speculation that we will have a decline over the next years at a minimum of stabilization. And the reason for that, I'm trying to remember the exact wording of the analysis, but when interest rates went up, when the federal funds overnight rate went up by 0.75% the other day, mortgage rates actually declined. Isn't that weird?
That's weird.
Weird. Yeah. So one of the things behind that was the mortgage companies are looking at a two-year timeline of where rates are going to be. And so the specific data that they looked at to determine, hey, this is where our rates should be right now if we're going to lock in a rate, even though the federal funds overnight rate went up, is a hint that we're either stabilizing or we're going to see a decline. So that's the best I can do. I don't really have
much. What are the current rates on investment properties? Joe wants to know.
Oh, that's hard to say. That's because they're all over the place. I mean, it's from a licensing standpoint, I probably shouldn't get too deep into those rates. But like, typically, I would say if whatever the rate is for what you're, if you're going to buy it and live in it, for conventional, you're probably a half a point to a point higher or more, depending on your credit. That's the other thing. It's so hard to say because
It's
based on so many factors. Because I mean, and what loan program? So it's like the I think the answer to it is what I've always said, and that is rates really don't matter. They don't. I mean, they matter to a certain extent. It's like, do you have cash flow? Can you achieve a goal with this property? But ultimately, like, that debt isn't going to last very long. 90% of mortgages are refinanced within 10 years. So, I mean, and especially once you get into the bigger stuff, I mean, the rates don't even last like 5 or 10 years, you know, that might be as long as the rate even lasts that you get. And then there are options that you can always like refinance. So rate is an ever-changing metric that you just have to be aware of, but you don't get married to it. You don't get married to the rate. You get married to you don't even really get married to the property. You get married to the cash flow. Money and the freedom. That's what you're in this for.
Yeah. Don't get emotionally connected to any of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It the bottom line is, do the numbers work? Is it gonna bring you the cash flow that you need to get to your freedom number, so that working a job that you have to punch a time clock becomes optional?
That's where
you want to get to, is that the job becomes optional. Adam, put your contact information there to everyone. Kyle, put yours there for everyone. I want everybody to see. Welcome, Adrian. Adrian just tapped into the call.
NMLS is 980119, in case I need that for some lawyer out there.
Yeah. So anyway, put your contact. I put mine there already. Mine is kathybenner.com. And so please join us. Kyle has his there, EXP Realty. Adam has his phone number, Adam Messmer with his phone number. And
Adam, I've got a question for you.
Earlier,
Adam mentioned rich guy activities. What are those and how do I sign up?
Yeah. That's a good question. Anything with yachts, usually. I mean, honestly, that's a big part of it, is it's like, where are you hanging out? Where do deals get done? Deals get done on golf courses. That's for sure. I hate golf. I don't golf at all. I'm like the only mortgage broker in the world that doesn't golf. I hate it. I go to Topgolf and I eat food and I sit and I look at the pretty weather because that's nice. And then there's usually a fan or something. Yeah. So I do that.
There's two different parts to this question. One is, where do you hang out to find folks that have money that want to be investors?
Real estate networking events.
Then the second part of this question is, once you reach your freedom number, you know, what is it that you want to do? And your freestyle living might be
hang out at real estate networking events. To find people to go make me more money. But honestly, there's a little bit of truth to that. Like, you get enough of these things, it's a community. I mean, you get to know people. Like, I never would have met you without going to these things. And you get to see what people are working on, what they're doing. I had a birthday recently, and there were a number of like real estate people, like work real estate people, like clients or just COIs or whatever, that were there because they're also friends. Like, I spend so much time on the phone with like corporate bankers and investors. I mean, mostly investors, but like you get to become friends with them, and they're cool people.
So it's all about who you're rubbing elbows with.
It is. Yeah.
How many times do you network a month, Adam?
Every day. I mean, it's depends. Like, formal events, there's usually three or four like big formal events. And then there's usually coffee or getting beer or getting dinner or getting lunch. Cause that's it too. It's also maintaining relationships. So it's not just going out and meeting new people. It's checking in with your network. What's everybody doing? You know, what do you got going on? And half of it is being likable and like easy to work with, like, answer your phone, answer texts, like,
yes,
you know, be responsive, and find how you can add value to the people that you're working with.
You know? Perfect. And that's what we want to do here, is we want to add tons of value, because we know when you finally do get to leave that 9-to-5 job and you are an investor and you're deciding that you can make this on your own, then you find yourself a solopreneur, and oftentimes you're working by yourself all day. And it's just so helpful to have, you know, to have your peeps around that you can bounce ideas off of, and deals, and is this a good deal? And that's why we started the boots on the ground, so that we could go out and actually, you know, look in the basements and look in the attics and find out, you know, what is it going to cost to rehab this property? And what do I need to look for in the future? So it's so valuable to make those connections. So I agree.
Mm-hmm.
So Kyle, what does freestyle living mean for you? What are the rich folks doing? What would you be doing if money were not an issue?
Personally, I want to travel the world. I wouldn't mind having a sailboat or a yacht. Absolutely.
Okay. I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Perfect.
I mean, if you're hanging out anywhere, I mean, just look at where rich people hang out, which they do hang out. They hang out all the normal places. They usually hang out fun places that are cool. Like if you go to cool, fun places.
If I have to golf to get rich, I'm willing to do that.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good, I'm not willing to do it. I don't want to, I mean, I should. You know what else is kind of cool that I've kind of recently started doing is sporting clays. Have you ever shot? So that's where you go out with a shotgun and you yell pull and a clay pigeon goes flying and you shoot it with a shotgun. It's the best. I'll tell you, I went the other day and all those birds are perfectly fine. Like I couldn't hit any of them. It was a nightmare, but it's a great thing. It doesn't take 4 hours. It takes like an hour and a half, which is great. Golf is like 4 hours of your life. Christine did it when she was 13. She said, yeah. Oh, it's the best. That's a great rich guy. There's tons of rich guys that love to do that. Go do that. And you will find tons of rich folks. Yeah. Oh yeah. Charity stuff, any kind of charity stuff. There's usually money floating around charity stuff, you know.
So we will mention, since you brought up charity stuff, we do have a scholarship program for anybody that wants to go to school to become a realtor. And so just, you know, get a hold of me or get a hold of Kyle and we can help you through that process as well. Mm-hmm. So good stuff. Adam, thank you so much. Adam's contact information is in the chat. When I upload this replay, I will include all of his contact information. I will also include Kyle's and mine. But just remember, go to kathybenner.com and scroll down to get to the actual replays. Christy says it's very informative and to thank you. So again, thank you, Adam. And thank you, Kyle, for being with us. And we will see everyone again next month. It's the first Tuesday of every month. And next month we are talking about fixing. So be sure and tune in.
Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, guys.